You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 417 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're coming to you in separate locations this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion Storm.
And I'm in Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
It's the Vincent Askew.
Oh, I was going to ask you about 17. Wow.
I don't know if I have like anyone else in my my database here with 17. I mean, obviously, as all the listener know, Vincent Askew wore both number 17 and number 2 for the Sonics. He was number 2 during the title run, the finals run, but the title run still waiting on that one. But I got to say, my fondest
memories. I mean, it happened in 1979, just not with Vincent Askew.
True. And not with us being alive. I would say my fondest memories of Vincent Askew are wearing the green and gold and wearing that number 17 earlier in his Sonics tenure.
For sure.
There was him doing a pull-up on the rim. I actually don't. That's funny. He's not in here. I'm missing two notable quarterbacks and probably three notable quarterbacks. Dave Craig.
Okay.
Keith Price did nothing wrong.
Oh, Keith Price. I knew there was a 17, an important 17 that we were missing.
And Chris Chandler.
Oh, Chris Chandler, taking it way back.
Taking it way back, yes.
So. There was an official announcement of the college NCAA football 25 this last week, the release date, July 19th, I believe was the date. I'm like, Luke is at school. We got him a PlayStation 5, literally just for the intent of me playing NCAA football 25, where I was like, there was a clock set. The second that they announced it, there was a clock set where I was like, I'm going to be purchasing a PS5 before this happens. And then that ad came and I screen capped the Huskies in the ad, even seeing the players like having like Jalen Milroe, Quinn Ewers. But I screen capped the dogs in the rain coming out of the tunnel. It could not be better than that. I am so hyped for college football right now. But yeah, Carson Bruner, just like the helmets coming down. I was like, damn, it's one of those moments. It's been pouring rain in Seattle all day. I've been so depressed. But the thought of Husky Stadium in the fall in the rain, let's fucking go.
You say that now, but you're going to be miserable when we're there.
No, I'm not going to be miserable. At least the first time. You know, it's fun when it happens at first. Oh, my God.
You know what the thing is, though? It can no longer be Oregon State in the rain.
That's true. I mean, it could be, but...
It can. I mean, we'll see if they schedule them as a non-conference opponent.
Practically, it probably won't be.
I don't think you're going to play both of the Pac-2 every year. It's not going to be Arizona State, and you're wondering, hey, why is Arizona State better at playing in the rain than UW is?
There's nothing like a game against Indiana in the rain.
There may be some rain back in the Midwest as
just
well.
Just wait till you've seen Northwestern UW in the rain.
Oh, dear. I mean, but it's just memories.
The thing is, there's a lot of other teams in the Big Ten.
I'm aware there were a lot of teams
in that NCAA Football 25 ad who are in the Big Ten, and there's a lot of other teams who are in the Big Ten.
That is a fair point, but there's just not the historical trauma of Oregon State and the rain.
We're making new trauma, people. We can't wait. Anyway, I saw that, and I saw the Huskies go by, and I'm so hyped. And then I had to go back and screen cap the dogs coming out of the tunnel in the rain. There's literally nothing better.
It was very exciting to see Husky Stadium.
Husky Stadium in there, the greatest setting in college football in video game form. I can't freaking wait. Like, they never were able to replicate it back in the day, but now they're going to be able to.
Yeah, I mean, I read ESPN, one of my colleagues had a feature on the making of the game where they talked about the detail that they're going into for, you know, the traditions at various schools. And it's a whole new ball game, literally, for college football. And awesome that the players are benefiting now. And no one more so in college basketball. The Great Osabor, as we'll talk about later.
Oh, wow, we haven't even talked about Great Osabor?
No.
A lot has happened. Let's get through all this other stuff.
I mean, I assume this is primarily going to be a women's basketball pod this week. Or you're just already out on the Storm, both their 1-3 start. So is that what you're telling me here? Oh, wow.
I don't think
Wow.
it's going to be a women's basketball pod this week.
Oh, okay. Given, I don't know where you're going with this one, but I'm curious to
No,
see it. Well,
I'm just saying that the women's basketball hasn't been good.
it has not been good this thus
And
far,
Great
but we
Osabor has been great.
it's true. Always this. Never anything else. Well, it's also, in addition to being the Vincent Askew episode, it is the MVP edition of the PeltonCast for 2024. And congrats to your 2024 PeltonCast MVP, Abandoned Searches, which got 53% of the vote to your 37%.
A runaway. It's like the Mariners playoff odds. Like, even better. Or
With the
not
famous
even
cousin
as
Katie
good.
and I. Yes, not as good. The famous cousin Katie and I getting 5% each.
Robbed. How many abandoned searches were there? Just one in the past year?
In the past year, I think technically,
Step
well,
your game up, abandoned searchists.
yeah, because barbecue was abandoned in the summer of 2022. That was also, was that the same year of search for Seattle's most Seattle person?
That was almost like a never started search.
I mean, I think it still falls under the category of abandoned searches. And then, obviously, most famously, the search for Seattle's best IPA, which about a month into you stopped drinking. And now I
Didn't really like
basically.
drinking IPAs anyway, so I argued against that search to begin with, if it means anything.
But you came around on it. It's not like I
I
foisted it on you.
accepted it. I accepted it. I didn't come around on it. The two things we're good at is concluding searches and also abandoning searches. That's the
Oh,
thing. You
well.
know that you know what they say, fire fast, hire slow. That's what we're doing with these abandoned searches. You know what I mean? We're firing fast. If the search isn't working, let it go. Hire slow on the new searches. You don't want to just jump into a new search right away. You
I
want to
think that's
take your
the exact
time.
opposite of what we're doing. I think we're hiring slow because we're choosing the searches and then firing fast because we're abandoning them.
Yeah, that's still good.
Is it? That's, I believe that's the Phoenix Suns model of hiring head coaches.
Fire fast, hire slow.
Yeah.
That's the model of have they hired and fired a
Actually, I
lot of
don't
head
know. I think
coaches?
what I would conclude is we're hiring fast, firing fast. I guess that's what I
Hiring
actually
fast,
conclude.
firing fast.
That's the
There's
Suns
a
model.
lot going on here. But the thing is, I don't want people to think that this cookie search is not going to reach its conclusion.
It's going to be
Because
abandoned for this particular week because we didn't have any cookies logistically.
in honor of the MVP, we had to give it a week for this cookie search. We are deep in this cookie search, though. And that's the thing. I feel like we've been pretty deep on a lot of different things. Sometimes you just have to realize we started a search. Hey, after I experienced the search, it wasn't exactly what we were looking for. And then we let it go.
I'm still a little
So
disappointed about the barbecue search because that was one where I was learning about barbecue. I was
I
learning
don't
about myself.
recall why we abandoned the barbecue search.
I think you did not have the free time to go get barbecue on a regular basis. That seemed to be the issue.
Happy to pick back up the barbecue search. I the IPA search, I think that's abandoned forever. Search for Seattle's most Seattle person, gone forever.
I'm not going to say
However,
the IPA is abandoned forever, although I haven't been drinking lately either. So it's a real problem for the search if neither Belton brother is involved.
we will pick back up that barbecue search. So help me God. That is a search on pause.
I think that's a fair description. I don't know if I want to eat barbecue on a weekly basis from a health standpoint at this point in my
You keep
life.
saying that, and I keep saying you're either competing or you're not.
Well, sometimes I'm not competing then.
All right, fine.
What Pete Carroll would actually say as part of the Win Forever philosophy is that I'm just competing in a different dimension, which is heart health. Well, sadly, someone who will not be competing on the field for a period of time. We're pouring out some Peroni this week for Sam Haggerty, who suffered an Achilles rupture in a play Saturday with the Tacoma Rainiers, where he ended up colliding with the outfield wall while
Oh.
pursuing a ball in center field. It was pretty evident from the tweets right away that this looked bad, and the fears were confirmed by an MRI that he has an Achilles rupture and will, certainly be out the remainder of this season, possibly into 2025 as well.
It's devastating news. losing Haggerty, but there is a little bit of a part of it where it's like, I mean, I don't wish injury on anybody, but not having to have two Italians compete with each other for playing time, right? It's very nice to be able to just confidently be like, Dominic Canzone, he's our Italian now. He's the one.
I mean, I think there was a scenario, as we saw last September, where Canzone could have been a starting outfielder, and there was still a role for Haggerty to play in September in particular as a pinch runner and defensive sub and platoon, you know, right-handed batter, although there's a little less need for that for the Mariners at this point. They have plenty of right-handed bats who should not be playing against right-handed pitching. More than enough of those on the roster already. But yeah, it's a huge bummer. I mean, Haggerty was a key part of what made the 2022 season in particular so fun with Chaos Ball, but last season as well. So, you know, hope to see him back on the field sooner rather than later. But you wonder if that's going to be in a Seattle Mariners jersey the next time we see him.
I think I would be pretty confident that it won't be, that we've probably seen the last of Sam Haggerty as a Mariner. But I do think there's certain players like this where they just have to burn. They have to burn hot. We have to love those experiences. And then we can't hold on to those experiences too much. If we really love Sam Haggerty, we have to let him go. And we will be talking about, in the same way that we talk about Luis Soho, that we talk about Doug Strange, that we talk about Alex Diaz, we'll be talking about Sam Haggerty.
All members of the 1995 Mariners. That's the entirety of your reference. We could throw in like
Mariner, but there's others, right? People talk about Willie Bloomquist, Bucky Jacobson, people like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bloomquist is a little different because he was here such a long period of time. But yes, I was going to say throw out Stan Javier. I have such fond memories of Stan Javier.
I have no memories of Stan Javier.
Yeah. Ben McLemore was a little too good to qualify for this
Mark
list, probably.
Mark McLemore is like a starting everyday player. He doesn't count. Do you not even know what we're talking about here? It's a utility player.
That's why I said he's too good.
Burst. Yeah.
But I did call him Ben McLemore.
Is definitely not too good.
Ben Haggerty, too good.
In the same way that like Samad Taylor, that just like cup of coffee Samad Taylor had, I will forever be like, you know, Samad Taylor, maybe he could have made it.
I mean, I think that he has the chance to play that role that I talked about of being the 26th guy on the roster in September, the 27th. I don't know. There's already 26, aren't there? In my head, the rosters are still 25 and only 10 of them are pitchers because that's the number that there were in Griffey baseball during the season of record.
That's all that matters. Is that this? I thought 95 was the season of record, not 93.
We're hazy on that. 93 is like the baseball season of record, but 95 is the Mariners season of record, okay, is the way enough that I think of it.
I do agree.
Mark McLemore started in 2001.
It's so funny that everybody thinks that the peak of something happening was exactly when it happened, when they were basically like 10 years old or whatever. There was a story that I got sent about Bumbershoot where they were like, the heydays of Bumbershoot. And they're like, going to go see Bob Dylan. And I'm like, dog, Bumbershoot was washed by the time that happened. And of course, for me, the heyday of Bumbershoot, I'm like, well, it was obviously when I was 15. That's the heyday of Bumbershoot. And I do think maybe there are certain things that exist for people to be in a certain age, and you will always think they're better in that age and then always think they're worse after, which for us is the entire major league. So the season of record is just 1993, because we will never from this point forward pay as much attention to the rest of the league as we were able to in Griffey baseball era.
Oh, 100%.
I don't know if Baseball Tonight is still on, but I know I'm not watching it.
Mark McLemore started 100 games in 2001. So it's too many, but it's not like he started 162.
You know my feelings about the 2001 Mariners.
I do know.
For other people, there are other people who grew up like 2001 Mariners. That's, to me, I'm just like, the Mariners are done by 2001.
There's been an entire podcast about your feelings about the 2001 Mariners.
I love the only thing we can all agree on is like the 2012 Seahawks or something. That's, everybody can agree that team was fun.
Yes, that's fair. I should link that. For the new listener, we once went on the Lookout Landing podcast. They had a series called Why I'm a Mariners Fan, which included, among others, Ben Gibbard. Well, we're on the topic of Ben's, sort of. And they had us on not to talk about why we were Mariners fans, but at that point, why we had stopped being Mariners
It's so
fans.
funny because I feel like my entire calendar is like determined by Mariners games now. Like
That's.
I will watch almost every single Mariners game if I can.
I'm
I'm
pretty
paying
confident.
$18 a month to watch these fuckers. It's almost a dollar a game.
Yeah, I suppose so. I re-listened to that episode in 2022 before we did our first ever Mariners emergency pod, not counting the Robinson Cano edition. And I think I did say in there confidently that I would jump on the bandwagon when the team was good. So I feel good about that
There you
prediction.
are. There you are.
It's good I got some prediction, right? All right,
Okay,
congrats.
we're still on the toasts.
Yes. It's an all toast edition. Oops, all toast. Congrats to UW Men's Crew, which won their 41st and for now final Pac-12 championship Sunday at Lake Natoma, not Lake Nakatoma, near Sacramento. The Huskies won 4 out of 5 races, all but the freshman 8. We did miss that previously. The Huskies beat both the Italy national team and Wisconsin in this month's Windermere Cup with actors from The Boys in the Boat on hand.
There we go. I don't know if I could cheer for all of that. In our oops all toasts, we pour one out for the storm season. No, okay, sorry.
Oh no, come on. It's been 4 games.
That was a little joke. That was a little joke just for you.
You're pouring some out for the Italy national team not winning. Would you root for the Italy national team over UW and Crew?
I would be torn.
I mean, if the Italy national soccer team played US UW men's soccer, like there's no
I like
question
the
where my
Italian national
loyalties
soccer
are
team's
not.
odds
I also think that
also.
would be a better matchup for Italy than this Crew matchup was.
I was cheering for Chiellini against the Sounders.
Yeah, but that bar is pretty low for you now.
I went to a game on Saturday. Did you
That's
even know that I
true.
was there? Yeah.
Yes, because you posted about it on Instagram. You told me nothing about it, but once I saw and got notifications about your post on Instagram, I learned you were at the game.
There you go.
I'm curious to get your observations on it in the roundup. You might actually speak during the sounder section.
I've got all sorts of De La Vega thoughts.
He looked good.
I've heard of him. Now I was actually saying to Chris while we were there, I was like, I bet I've heard Kevin say this person's name
So many
over
times.
and over and over again, and I have no recollection of it. He
We
came
spent
on
like
and they were brand new words to me. I was like, I know these words together. I'm aware that that could be a name, but in context of the Sounders, I have not heard this before.
I mean, we spent like a month waiting for them to actually sign him after it was rumored that they were going to sign him.
I kind of remember that. He's Argentinian, right? Just like me.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes, just like you. All right, congrats to UW's Andy Powell, named Pac-12 Men's Track Coach of the Year for a second consecutive year after the Huskies repeated as conference champions.
You like that organ? Do you like that organ? We are
Wonder if you saw
faster,
this.
faster school.
Mike Vorol of the Seattle Times posted on Twitter that he interviewed Powell for a story, and Powell was like, "Yeah, so two of the three top mile runners in the state of Washington in high school this year are committed to us." And Vorol like made it as a joke, asked him, "So what happened to the third?" And he was like, "Oh, it's my son."
He left?
No, he's only a junior.
Oh, okay.
He is presumably coming to UW as his mom also coaches the track and field there, so. I like our odds on that one. Although I don't know, we did manage to hold on to Alexis DeBoer so far, despite Kalen leaving for Alabama. So you never know for sure, I suppose.
Feels a little different.
All right, lastly, in our oops all toasts, there's a new sponsor for the
Hello.
Seafair Unlimited Hydroplane
Poliachi
races.
pizza.
No, sadly. The boats are now racing for the Apollo Mechanical Cup. So there you go.
They certainly are still racing this race.
I mean, it's not as
It's
it was
like
the
the
home
goal, that's
street.
the exact same thing. We were like 8 to 10, and we were like, that is the glory days of hydro. Objectively, it was, but
I mean, whether it was the glory days relative to the 1980s or the 70s or the 60s, I mean, like this, like I think the 50s and 60s are pretty objectively the glory days of hydroplane racing when they were like reading about it regularly in Sports Illustrated and shit. But and like there were no Seattle professional sports in Seattle. The roundup was very short back then. They hadn't even invented women's sports at UW. Those were like objectively the heyday, but it is ob also objective that hydroplane racing has been going downhill in terms of interest for like three solid decades there. Since we were around age 10.
Since we were children. I mean, yeah, I
Are
don't want to
we
say it's a coincidence.
The problem? Is it us?
I
Am
almost
I
want to
the
talk
asshole?
about, I feel like we've never talked about this, but I started thinking about, we were at the Rolling Stone show, and I've been
I
thinking
was
about this a
wondering whether
lot
this was
lately,
going to come
actually,
up.
about the like nostalgia curve that happens of basically like a generation of people thinks that something is amazing because they perceived it while they were children, right? I want to talk about this more later, but like, I remember being a kid in high school and feeling like there was no good new music because the people who defined what was, quote, I mean, as if any music is like objectively good or bad or whatever, we're operating in those terms. And the people who were defining what was like classic albums at the time, basically we're just talking about records that came out when they were children, right? Because music
Or,
that.
I mean, I think with music, it's a little different. I don't think it's age, 10, like you're talking about with
No,
sports
it's
teams.
a little
It's
bit older.
like
It's
18 to 22, maybe 18 to
something around there.
25.
It's probably closer to like, it might be a little bit younger, but like you go back and listen to some of that music, the music that when I was in high school, I was like, oh, these are classic albums. And they are objectively kind of bad, many of them. Like I'll go back and listen to like even like classic albums, and I'm like, damn, there's like. Like I used to love the album Beggar's Banquet by the Rolling Stones, and my favorite song was a song called Jigsaw Puzzle, and I listen to it now and I'm like, kind of doesn't hit anymore. You know, there's something about it where you have to be in this world that old white people are telling you that something is great, and all of a sudden that era has faded, right? And you listen to the songs and you're like, ah, man, maybe Limp Bizkit was better than this. Like there is something about
Wait,
that time
what?
period. I'm just saying because we're now in that exact period where kids to kids like Korn, classic, that's like classic rock,
Yeah,
right?
no,
Those
that's
types
fair.
of bands, and they're being perceived in the same way that for us, like 60s, 70s classic rock was being perceived. All of a sudden, it's like there's not an idea of like critical music in the same way as there was when we were the kids because there's not like a Rolling Stone or
There's
something.
a lot of diffusion, yeah. Diffusion.
And
Diffusion.
there's not as many platforms talking about like what are the classic albums anymore. It is a very different way of perceiving things. But those are kind of like the classic albums now. Creed is cool again, right? Whereas at the time, Creed was cringe. Now Creed is cool. And I do wonder if you were a cool person in 1970 or whatever, like you probably fucking hated a lot of the music that has now become like the like classic albums. I was kind of thinking about that, but how it disseminates down to younger generations. And that for me, I was like, there's no good rock bands anymore because all of the music that was critically successful, people had gotten old by the time the next generation of music came, and those critics just got older, but they maintained their jobs and they didn't love the music that came next as much as they loved the music that defined them when they were 18 or whatever.
Do you think Fred Durst is still going to be running down the stage at age 80?
Maybe.
I don't like his odds. We'll wish him the best, but Mick Jagger might be 1-1 on that one. All right, anything else on the Rolling Stones?
Did you have anything on the Rolling Stones?
No, I was just curious if the Pelton brothers go to the Rolling Stones was going to come up. With that, it's time for Coach's Corner.
Speaking of pouring one out,
Yeah.
we pour one out on Mateo's football season. Taken down by a broken arm at his brother's baseball practice. I always want to be like, you should see the other guy. And then it's just a tee.
What?
He slid into home plate and a baseball tee and broke his arm.
I
So
didn't hear
he.
that full context of the story. I just knew it happened when he was running the bases.
Honestly, the other guy was unfazed. So he he was committed. The first thing he was upset about when he broke his arm was that his football, he was scared he wouldn't be able to play football anymore for the rest of the year. He was like, I'm quitting sports forever first, because he's upset. And then he was like, but what happens to my football season? You know, this Bills team is kind of on fire right now. So he was pretty devastated. We were like, that's okay. You can be the assistant coach. You can call some plays, like to come out there. He came out, came to the game bright and early. He was there cheering on his teammates, to getting a little bit too close to throwing the ball. He's going to get probably pretty good throwing left-handed. Nice. He got to be the captain in the game. And he also, play he really wanted to run was the all flea flicker offense, which honestly would work better if the I feel like running a flea flicker requires more of the defense than is happening yes. in children's in first grade football. Like, you have to have people who are going to crash down on the handoff. And the reality is, if receivers start running as far as possible, every defender is going to start running as far as possible, even if it's just a straight handoff. So the flea flicker is not quite as great, but he did get a flea flicker called as the coach of the team. So he transitioned to his natural place as coach, because that's where he's going to end up.
His very Pelton place.
Yeah. He or was Carter there. Cedar, I was there say. As coach. I mean, it was a massive win, a big win against the Texans this last week. Things were dicey for a second. It was a little bit closer, but then we pulled away. They honestly kind of missed Mateo as quarterback, because they're like two quarterbacks, but you know, there were some, they got a little bit thin in the pass game at some point.
Are we coming? Is this the final week of the regular season?
No, there's a few more, but I probably am not going to do. Literally, it is coach's corner for Mateo.
Yes, we'll bring him on the pod to do coach's corner in the future, but too much profanity. We probably can't do it. All right, since we have no cookie search this week, that brings us to your favorite segment.
When I do the coach's corner and this back-to-back, it always feels so crazy.
You talk a lot, and then I do the roundup, and I talk a lot.
But now I've got thoughts on De La Vega.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Last week, I told you about how Julio was back. Well, you know, I hate to admit this, but I was wrong. Julio's fine, but he's still not back yet, because there is a new definition of what back means. In a season like this for the Mariners, when you run away with the division, don't even look at the Fangraphs playoff odds. They're too good. You'll jinx it. But in a season like this, it takes the unsung heroes to redefine what back means. Here's an ode to the unsung heroes who have carried the Mariners through their toughest stretch of the season, leading them to a 5-3 record against three of the best teams in the AL. He's not Jake Fraley. He's not John Fraley. It's motherfucking boy, Luke Raley. Sometimes when you're on an 8-game hitting streak, it means you have 8 hits, not for Luke, who has been raking during that time period, showing the speed to leg out an infield single in the most important win of the year, and then capping it off with a massive dinger to ice away the Yankees for a second straight night. He has played so well. We're Zoe Deschanel in 2012. We're not even thinking about Death Cabbie for Cutie. And they've been able to kintsugi the roster together with, he's not Luis Castillo, he's not George Kirby, he's our number one starter and all-star, it's Brian Wu. Pitching against maybe the best bats in the American League, Wu continued his domination. The gem he tossed, 2 hits, no runs, 7 strikeouts, was the best of the best. And we have to start thinking in stratospheric levels for Wu now. He is Pedro in 99. He is Randy Johnson in 2002. And the rest of the AL West are a bird in spring training, because there is another utility player in town. He's not Luis Soho. He's not Willie Bloomquist. He's Dylan Moore. I had written off Demo so many times. He was basically a home office expense. But he is back for the first time. As we pour one out for our boy Swaggerty, Demo is plenty alive, cranking a number of huge hits in May, showing more pop than ever imagined, and out of respect for Sam, doing it alongside another of our brethren, because as long as the Mariners are number one, there always needs to be at least one.
Wow, well done. I didn't realize there was going to be so much Ben Gibbard in today's podcast
You mentioned
when
that, and
we
I was like,
started
wow, that's coming up again.
out. Also, kind of mean to do that to noted Mariners fan Ben Gibbard. But yeah, Dylan Moore. You know, I think the biggest thing that Dylan Moore had going against him for a long period of time is that he's not Italian. So how
That
dare
actually
he?
is I that actually is true. If Dylan Moore was Italian, he'd be one of my favorite Mariners.
Without question. But I mean, the stretch that he had filling in for JP Crawford, now you've got the ability to have both of them in the lineup. He played second today with Crawford's return to the starting lineup, with Jorge Polanco still sitting out with hamstring tightness. So,
I will note that kind of didn't even notice that Jorge Polanco wasn't there.
like, you kind of got to keep Dylan Moore's bat in the lineup. He has the highest, it was noted on the Discord, the highest OPS of anyone in the lineup today, which
He's
is
from—he's such a just
quite
a
wild.
white baseball player. He's from like suburban California, went to college in Florida, Cypress College for 2 years before transferring to UCF.
Yeah,
Drafted
that
by
all
the
checks out.
Rangers, like that guy. This is a baseball player.
But I thought you were going to say that Luke Rayleigh was playing so well. We were scouring to see if he had any Italian heritage.
Oh. I'm happy to do so. He probably was like raised in California.
I'm
Or to
sure.
get, I would, oh
California,
no, he's from
Arizona, or
Ohio.
Florida.
I knew this. We knew he because he went to Ohio State.
Oh, that's right. Yes. That's one of the things we talked about on the podcast that I completely forgot, like the entire Sounders section, all the discussions of Pedro de la Vega for you. Yeah, I mean, Rayleigh has been awesome. Moved up to hitting third in the lineup today, which
Wait, did
was
he not? He didn't go to
wild.
Ohio State. I knew he was from Ohio. It was somebody else who went to Ohio State then. Was that Mitch
Oh,
Garver?
it was it the, no, it wasn't Kanan Smith and Jigba. I mean, that's just Jackson that went there. You're right, though. We definitely talked about someone going to Ohio State.
After going undrafted out of high school, he enrolled at Lake Erie College. Huh? What a kind of a strange path to the majors for Luke Rayleigh.
What else was involved here?
That he played like Cape Cod Baseball League.
Okay.
He
Good
was
for Luke
drafted by the
Rayleigh.
Dodgers in the seventh round.
I mean,
I mean, I freaking, it was so funny. And like, I was very down on Luke Rayleigh at the beginning of the season before you really understood who Luke Rayleigh was. He's the best hitter on the team now. The way that he's moved up the lineup and the combination that he has of speed and average and power, you're kind of like, I think Luke Rayleigh might actually just be really good. It's not like a Dylan Moore situation where you're like, okay, Dylan Moore like has a few hits, but we know who Dylan Moore is. Luke Rayleigh might actually be an like if you were to tell me in 5 years that at some point Luke Rayleigh made an all-star team, I'd be like, yeah, that kind of checks out.
how old is Luke Rayleigh?
He's 29.
It'd be pretty surprising, but there is like a trade. It's Canzone is the one who went to Ohio State.
Wait,
That's what
really?
we're
Okay.
forgetting. Yes. Or Canzone is noted by the Yankees fans who are annoyed by him. Yankees had not lost two games in a season in a row all season before the first two games of this series. And that game Monday, I had completely turned off. I don't know
Oh,
where
yeah.
you were on it.
Well, me and Jake Fraley have the same birthday.
Because coming off of this series against the Orioles, even though the Mariners did manage to scratch out a win, it just felt like there might be some levels to this shit in the American League, and they might
No,
be on a
it's kind
level.
of crazy how things went from the eighth inning yesterday to today.
Vibes change is pretty incredible. And you probably shouldn't swing that much on a couple of games, but you kind of needed the proof of concept that the Mariners. Because the thing I was thinking about is, like, obviously there have been 3-run comebacks in the ninth inning before. It's not like unprecedented, but to like have one run and look as inept offensively as the Mariners did throughout that entire game, and then explode for the four runs in the ninth inning, like, I mean, I only learned about it like an hour and a half after, and I was just stunned. And then obviously it carries over into the Woo start. I was a little worried that I was like, is the same thing going to happen in reverse today? But lo and behold, Ryan Stanek and Andres Munoz shut the door, and the Mariners got some insurance runs in the off the Yankees bullpen again.
It was close. Yeah, Ohio's the other place. Florida, Ohio, California. That's where baseball players come from.
So the Mariners now don't look now. Three games up in the American League West on the below 500 Texas Rangers. It is their first time ending the day with a three-game lead in the division, over a quarter in the way through the season since August 2003. So that's wild.
Three. I thought two was the. I thought so. Things hadn't fallen apart yet by three.
I believe three was the year that they fell apart for good. That was the Moneyball season, wasn't
Two was the year that they missed the playoffs in two, right? Or did they made the playoffs in
No, they
three?
missed the playoffs in both two and three.
Okay. 2002, I thought they were up and then they fell apart late in the season.
I mean, I think it was pretty similar. They finished 93 and 69 both seasons.
God. And that was an era that you could finish 93 and 69 and miss the playoffs.
Right. Yes. Nowadays, that would not be the same kind of issue. Yeah, they were up 7 in July, still up 4 at times in August, and then finished 3 games out. And third in the AL West behind Oakland and Anaheim, I do believe. So, no, they actually finished second. I guess I don't know who was the wild card that year. Boston Red Sox. Boston Red Sox. So there you go. Two
Who
more
had the
games
same
left.
record?
No, they were 95 and 67. They were two games up.
Oh,
Are
that's
you looking
2002.
at 2002?
I'm looking at two.
Yeah, in 2002 was the year that Oakland and Anaheim made it. The Mariners finished third with night in the division with 93 wins.
And the Mariners would have been the third wild card that year.
Yes. Possibly the second, depending on the tiebreaker with Boston. So the Mariners, two more left with the Yankees before they finish this road trip in DC against the Nats. Pelton Cat's golden rule. I don't want to say I'll feel good about the road trip, even no matter what happens going forward, but they've already been more competitive
Guaranteed
against the Yankees.
500 in the stretch with the Royals, Orioles, and Yankees.
Yeah, that's a good
And
way to think about it.
to go 500 during that stretch with seven of those on the road, I think the Orioles might be something else. I know that I think the Yankees lead the AL East,
They do.
but they're both scary. When it was like they might pitch hit Jose Trevino and then let, and then they're like, and here comes Giancarlo Stanton. You're like, they have him too?
I mean, the thing that today felt like to me, I mean, obviously Giancarlo Stanton wouldn't be pinch hitting in this scenario, but it felt a lot like a playoff game, frankly. Like we've had some of these matchups with the Yankees before. If you go back to the 2022 series in Seattle that sort of catalyzed the PeltonCast's Mariners fandom, led to the Carlos Santana theme song. That felt like a playoff preview, and today's game in particular did as well to me. Even
Yeah,
though the scary, the
most
wild
games
thing
in
is,
May in baseball, you should probably think of as playoff previews. Nothing changes between May and October.
I don't think you're understanding my point, which is just like the level of competition and the quality of players involved. That's the part of it that felt like a playoff game.
Yes. But also you're saying that the Yankees have a lot of good players.
I am saying that, but.
Playing the Yankees feels
But
like
like it
playing a
was
playoff
all,
game.
but like the Orioles games did not feel like playoff games. Maybe
Because
Saturday
they
did.
kind of summarily crushed the Mariners
There,
ultimately.
and they're also like that's there's the tension of baseball playoffs that today felt a lot like. I don't know. Maybe that's unfair. Let me know in the Discord if people agreed with that assessment. But the wild thing is, despite your Brian Wu comparisons, like if the Mariners started the playoffs today, Brian Wu isn't starting games.
We'll see, but yes.
Long ways to go, but yeah, we'll see. But that is it, their pitching depth is pretty wild.
Brian was awesome. Having him back, I mean, just even subbing out just the Emerson Hancock starts for Brian Wu starts is it kind of changes the whole team. Like
Oh, for
the I
sure.
noticed the runs allowed, like the Mariners have given up some runs. Their pitching hasn't been as good as it has been. The offense has been a little bit better and the pitching hasn't been as good. But just flipping those starts, the Hancock starts or the Wu starts changes everything.
100%. All right, to the roundup. Starting with our Calder Cup playoffs update, Coachella Valley swept the Ontario Reign 3-0 to reach the Western Conference Finals, where the Firebirds will face the winner of the Grand Rapids Milwaukee series, currently tied 1-1. Elliot Friedman of TSN reported on the Kraken's coaching vacancy. Seattle, I think there's three names: Dan Bylsma, Todd McClellan, and Jay Leach. Bylsma is currently coaching Coachella Valley, fittingly enough, after serving as the head coach of the Penguins, where he won a Stanley Cup as a rookie head coach in 2009, and the Buffalo Sabres. McClellan was fired by the Kings in February, coming off a 100-point season, previously coached in San Jose and Edmonton, leading both of those teams to 100-point seasons as well. And Leach was an assistant throughout Dave Hextall's time as Kraken head coach, interviewed with your Rangers last year. But this would be his first opportunity as a head coach if he is hired to replace Hextall.
Now, of course, I've never heard of any of these people, but based upon the description, I feel like Todd McClellan is probably the dude.
I mean, Bylsma's had like the greatest playoff success and is also in the organization with the Coachella Valley affiliation. I wouldn't be surprised if it's him.
I'm not saying who it is, but who I think it should be.
I suppose. I don't take any particular opinion on who it should be. I'm not convinced any of it matters. I think it's all window dressing. They keep firing. It's like the Pelton cast searches. They keep hiring and firing coaches, and teams win or lose, and it doesn't seem to make a lot of difference either way.
I think your theory about coaches, I actually think, is totally wrong. I think it's the exact opposite. I was thinking about this. The amount that you can just tune out a coach, it just, after a couple of years, you're just like, I'm good. I've heard it, dog. Like, I'm good. You're doing your thing. There are very few coaches that are going to, and this is in sports where coaching matters less scheme-wise, if that makes sense. Like basketball, football, I think coaching matters more because it's literally their choices to make. There's not like a choice to make in hockey where you're like, we're either going to try to score or not. You know, like in football, you can pass the ball or you can run the ball, and that choice that you make literally changes your chances of winning the game. In all the other sports, more or less everybody's trying to do the same thing in baseball, basketball, hockey. So I think if there's a coach and it turns even a little sour for a second, or the players start tuning them out, find a new guy.
I suppose maybe they're not actually tuning them out, and maybe you're just getting bad luck, because that's almost always what you get fired for.
Is bad luck? I don't know if that's true.
And then people retcon. I don't know if I would say that you almost
always get
fired.
But then you just go get a new job somewhere else. Look at all of these names. They've all been coaches. It's just a little shuffling. And you have a new person yelling at you. And that's
it. Then you've got moving expenses.
I'm not weeping for Todd McClellan right now.
I'm not weeping for anyone either. I'm just saying, if it doesn't matter, then you shouldn't bother changing.
I do.
Because there are transaction costs associated with changing.
There are honeymoon periods, though, that you have with new people around, and you should just constantly,
but again, I just don't know that I believe the evidence actually shows that. I think that's a retcon of regression to the mean. The honeymoon period that you're referring to is just getting lucky, and then the regression mean to the mean happens.
Is there a statistical, like,
I mean,
history of teams playing better under new head coaches? And have you looked at that in basketball?
Yeah, the evidence is teams play worse on average under new head coaches. And I'm pretty sure that's true in football as well.
Fair enough.
Seattle Sounders. Rough midweek match on Wednesday in Salt Lake. They rested several starters to begin the game, including Christian Rodan and Jordan Morris, while Leo Chu left in the 21st minute with an injury. They conceded in the 27th minute, then again in the 58th, and had just two shots on goal and 0.7 XG in a 2-0 loss. On Saturday, with Tristan in attendance, Jordan Morris grabbed the opening goal 9 minutes in after a series of deflections in the box. The Sounders controlled play into stoppage time when Nuhu was yellow carded for a foul, and then VAR determined he committed a handball in the box on a subsequent play, earning a second yellow and a penalty for the Whitecaps, who converted to share the points, despite Pedro de la Vega subsequently testing the woodwork in his return to the lineup from a hamstring injury. What did you see?
Honestly, they were really playing soccer, and I think that was kind of the main thing. There was things moved crisply. Like, everybody was trying to score. It was one of those setups where in a 1-0 game, there's the Sounders weren't time wasting. You know, they were trying to score another goal. There was a play where I felt like I don't know. When you're at the stadium, it's always hard. Like the new who yellow, the second new who yellow, the handball, like it was literally right in front of me, but I couldn't, you can't see it live. It happened so fast.
No.
And even on the replay, like they show it for a second and you're like I assumed that they were going to give him the second yellow and give them the penalty kick because it was taking a long time. And I don't know. It was what it was. It was fine.
I mentioned this was a couple weeks ago, the handball call against Sifuya Huerta in the rain match. I thought it was a pretty tough one. This one to me seemed pretty open and shut. His arm was away from his body. He made contact with the ball in the box. Like that's the rules. I think it's actually kind of a ridiculous rule, but
there was a similar play that they looked at. They didn't go all the way to VAR.
They should have VAR'd that at the very least. Yeah.
That was the one you can
complain about for the Sounders.
I don't get why they didn't look further at it. Because again, it hit the Whitecaps defender in the arm. His arm looked like it was outstretched at least slightly. And so to call one and not the other felt a little bit questionable, but.
Right. But I don't think they could have not called that one just because they didn't call the previous one.
But De La Vega at the same time, when he came in, it was noticeable. The pace that he had and how he moved around offensively. I think if they're able to find spots for him, he's going to make a difference for a team that's kind of seemed like they've struggled a little bit offensively.
Yeah, I mean, they've been able to create a decent number of XG, have not had the ability to finish, and have not been elite, certainly, in XG, not at the level that they have been in the past. So I think that was encouraging, although it was a tremendous bummer to only get a point out of that match after basically dominated the entire way. And I assume that was kind of the mood in the stadium, but like long term, there were positives to take from it. You can neither confirm nor deny that was the mood in the stadium.
That was the mood in the stadium. Yeah, okay. I agree. I mean, what else would be the mood be?
I fair.
It's a draw that feels like a loss. There are draws that feel like wins, and there are draws that feel like losses. And it was a draw that feels like a loss.
Wow, the XG was actually slightly better for Vancouver. That's wild. That did not match my sense of that match. All right, on Tuesday night, Sounders in the round of 16 in the U.S. Open Cup facing Phoenix Rising from the USL. Brian Schmetzer told reporters Tuesday that the Sounders plan to take it seriously. We'll see exactly how many starters. Nuhu probably gets the start in this one because he can't play at the weekend because of the red card suspension. So, you know, definitely an opportunity here for some of the younger players on the Sounders roster who stepped up to help them get to this point with their first U.S. Open Cup win to keep this going, and nice to have it again at Starfire. At the weekend, Sounders back to MLS play Saturday at St. Louis. St. Louis City currently 2 points ahead of the Sounders for the last Western Conference playoff spot after those two teams finished 1-2 in the West last year. St. Louis offense hasn't been nearly as potent this season. They saw their 23-year-old co-leading scorer, Nicholas Cecchini, join Italian club Como in January.
Did you just say that St. Louis and the Sounders were 1-2 in the West last year?
That's correct.
You didn't say that.
I did say that.
It
is a factual thing.
Are you sure? You're sure of that information?
Yeah.
St. Louis.
Yeah.
And the Sounders were first and second in the Western Conference.
I can double check it.
I feel like the Sounders never play well.
No, they did last year. You just don't remember it because it's in the roundup segment. I think LAFC last year. So LAFC was, yeah, they were third. Went on to, I believe, win the Western Conference. They're like not very good this season either.
Huh.
So very topsy-turvy in the Western Conference is my takeaway. Portland, which is almost always good, still languishing behind the Sounders and the standings. Very strange Western Conference standings today. LAFC is fifth. They're a little higher than these two teams. Well, another team that has tumbled in the standings, Seattle Reign FC, after going behind 2-0 in the 18th minute, the Reign clawed even with 2 goals in 3 minutes from Bethany Balser and Anrad James, only to see Orlando's Barbara Banda grab a second goal that proved the winner, giving her sixth on the season. Good for second in NWSL. Reign dropped to 2-7-1 on the season, and the schedule doesn't get much easier as they head on the road Friday to face the Washington Spirit, who sit third in the NWSL standings. It's time to talk about the Storm. Season began last week with high expectations. Skylar Diggins-Smith, Neko Ogwumike joining Jewel Lloyd. Storm seemingly back into contention, tied for the third highest over-under, third best title odds. And they start the season 1-3 in their opening week. Lost both games home and away against the Minnesota Lynx. Then a back-to-back to complete that road trip Sunday at Washington, Monday at New York. Finally got their first win against the Mystics. Unsurprisingly lost to the Liberty, who kind of look like the best team in the WNBA right now. So it's 1-3. And the big picture for the Storm, their 87 offensive rating is last in the WNBA. They're turning the ball over on 22% of their possessions, which is the fourth most. Neither Skylar Diggins-Smith nor Jewel Lloyd has yet shot 40% in a game. Lloyd's at 24% overall, 16% for three, although she has compensated with a career high 7.8 free throw attempts per game. And Diggins-Smith, one of 13 from three thus far and averaging five turnovers per game. I would say that to me is the biggest long-term concern of this. Like, Jewel Lloyd is going to find it. It's a bit troubling that the offense has just looked so muddy early on in her. Like, the whole point of bringing in Skylar Diggins-Smith and Neko Ogwumike is like Jewel, when she set the single season record for total points last year, led the league in scoring. You were having to shoulder too much of the load. Now there's these two other stars. You're going to get the better kind of shots that you got when you played with Sue Bird and Breanna Stewart. And so far, she hasn't been getting those shots. Her shot diet has been just as difficult as last season, maybe more difficult at times. So that's a concern. But to me, it's the fact that Skylar Diggins-Smith, at age 33, coming off of a second pregnancy, has not looked like the all WNBA first team player the last time we saw her on the court in 2022 with the Phoenix Mercury. Now, it's a long season. She's almost certainly going to shoot better from three and will probably continue to work into game shape. But I will admit that based on what we saw from Skylar Diggins-Smith in the preseason, where she looked very much like herself, I had higher expectations than this.
I think that's the biggest piece right now is the turnovers have just been crushing to watch, and the 3-point shooting. It's not pretty basketball at all that is
No.
happening at the moment. I watched the first two games or a good part of the first two games, and I mean the turnovers were the main thing that stood out. It's so strange watching NBA and then watching at least the Storm. They just don't shoot threes.
I mean, they're 18.3 per game. It's 11th in the WNBA thus far. And they're
Is that a
shooting
coach?
23% on them.
Is that a coaching thing? Or are they just not getting the shots? Is there an expectation that they weren't going to take as many threes?
No, I wouldn't say that was the expectation. I mean, you're playing kind of big with Neko Ogwumike and Ezi Magbegor in the front court, even though both of them can step out and shoot the three. But like, you look back to 2022, Noel Quinn's first full season as head coach, Storm were fourth in the league in 3-point attempts. They shot the second highest percentage after the Aces. Like, this was an outstanding shooting team. So it's not like a coaching philosophy of let's pound them inside, like old school. Like, no, Noel Quinn wants them to shoot more threes, and the offense just hasn't been generating them thus far.
How much of that, if you had to put, I blame, not necessarily the right word, but like responsibility for any of the issues that are happening on offense. To me, it's probably Skylar Diggins-Smith at the moment. Smith at the moment that I just feel like she's not running the offense very well,
I
and
mean, she
not having.
has racked up a lot of assists, but yeah, the turnovers have been bad. I mean, part of this is like, you're comparing NBA playoff games to the WNBA start of the season with 2 weeks of training camp. Like, I expected when I looked it up, oh, their turnover rate has got to lead the league, right? And like, no, they're actually fourth. It probably
Everybody's just
helps.
turning the ball over a ton right now.
It probably helps a little bit that they've played four games thus far. And, some of the game teams entering Monday when these stats were compiled had only played two.
Okay.
So they've had a little more opportunity to work it out of their system, but definitely like this is what happens early in WNBA seasons.
Is concern level, where are we at concern level?
I think the idea that this is going to be one of the top three teams in the league is now very difficult to justify because Connecticut, and we'll talk about them a little more in a second, looks very much the part of one of the three or four best teams in the league. And then probably the most notable development on the flip side of the Storm start is Minnesota winning those two games against them and looking like they are going to be a very strong team this season. I thought they were a bit underrated. They were ahead of the Storm in my statistical projections, and they're off to a terrific start.
It still just felt to me like these were issues that, with the two new stars, they just haven't played together that much, right? You said there's 2 weeks of training camp.
It was abbreviated because you got the Olympic break this year, and they're trying to fit in 40 games in a smaller footprint than they had last year to do that.
It does feel like they're playing a lot of games very quickly, also.
And they've played, they tied for the most games in the league. Some of these other teams have had a gentler start to the season and a cross-continental road trip in there too.
I was just wondering if it's that they're older players, right? Skylar Diggins-Smith and Nneka Nwabuike are not young. And most of the other stars kind of around the league, like there are a lot of young stars around the league. It's not necessarily a terrible thing, but it's going to take a second to get things going for them to gel offensively. And that to me is the biggest difference because they're playing defense okay.
Yeah, they're fourth in defensive rating.
So the offense seems like it's just taking a second to get together. Do you feel like there's going to be a point in, say, mid-June or something where we'll be like all of a sudden the Storm are playing like the third best team in the league? Or do you think that is less likely now based upon the start? How much of this matters?
I mean, I don't have like a statistical answer to this. I would say
What
it's
is your
more art than science.
vibes answer to it?
Again, I don't think the ceiling is maybe quite as high as I thought. I don't think the floor is as low as it's looked. We should say Nneka Ogumahe has been awesome. She's been the best player on the team thus far, averaged a double-double the first two games. Then she rolled her ankle against Minnesota, has missed the last two games. And, they managed to beat Washington without her. We're fairly competitive against New York, but, her absence was very much felt. I think there's optimism she could return as soon as Wednesday night to the lineup. The other player, by the way, that they've been without is Nika Mule. This snuck up on us. We got an email like an hour or maybe 30 minutes before tip-off of the season opener that she was going to be unable to play due to a visa issue. So she was in the US on a student visa when she was at UConn and now has to convert it to a work visa. And we knew that this was why she was unable to travel to Canada for the exhibition game they played in Edmonton, but didn't realize it was still going to be a potential issue for her playing in games. And she has been upgraded to probable for Wednesday. So it sounds like there is strong optimism that she will be back on
So
the
she's
court.
in the country right now.
She was practicing with the team the entire way. She's on the was on the road trip. I don't know
What's the
for sure.
difference? If you literally the being in the country should be the issue with a visa, not playing basketball. I guess it's probably if
Like
it's a work
this
visa,
is
you can't work until you have the visa.
and so the one thing that we kind of teased out, and I haven't gotten anyone to confirm this, is she could play participate during training camp and play in a preseason game because technically you don't get paid for the preseason. You only get paid for the regular season. But this has left the Storm without one of their options at backup point guard. Keanna Williams, who made the team out of training camp, as I think we sort of, had an idea might happen when we did our season preview pod. She's gotten some of those minutes, and then they've gone with point Sammy Whitcomb some of those minutes, which the only positive of that is like if I have a criticism of the first week of the season, it's that Sammy Whitcomb needs to play more, especially if you need more shooting. Sammy is the answer. And Victoria Vivians has had some good moments the last couple of games. Jordan Horston has been terrific defensively so far, but neither of those players stretches the floor the way that Sammy does, and she's just one of your five best players.
How much do you expect, how much of a difference do you expect Nika Mule to play when she's back?
I mean, I wouldn't expect a huge difference, but if you're looking at turnover specifically, like playing without a traditional
Adding more
point
ball
guard,
handling.
it's going to be a positive.
Okay. What about around the league? We obviously saw the debut of Caitlin Clark last week.
Well, let's pose it this way, because we're going to have a battle of the 1-3 Storm against the 0-4 Indiana Fever on Wednesday night at Climate Pledge Arena. Caitlin Clark coming to
Oh,
town.
that's at Climate Pledge?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
There's more than one game at Climate Pledge then, right?
They're coming back on June 28th. Sadly, I will not be around for that one.
I was
So,
going to tell, I was going to say Jan bought tickets for it and I'm going to be gone because I'm going to be gone June 28th.
or June 27th, I should say. It's not the 28th. I will be gone for that one, sadly. So this will be my only opportunity to watch Caitlin in Seattle this season, boring somehow a playoff matchup, which would be very exciting, I think, at this point for both of those teams. So, like, they are also off to a slow start in some of the same ways, intriguingly. Caitlin, through her first four games, has 26 turnovers. She shot 7 of 23 her first two games, including 1 of 7 from three in her second game as they got blown out by the Liberty. Last two games, we've seen it look more like herself. 12 of 28 from the field, 7 threes in that span. Turnover's still an issue, but somewhat less so. She rolled her left ankle in the first half on Monday against Connecticut, but did return to the game for the second half and said after, "It'll be a little stiff, but I'll be good." I don't know if I saw the status report from the Fever, but I think the anticipation is she should be able to play on Wednesday, which would obviously be a tremendous disappointment if she wasn't.
And
And we see some of the same issues, I would say, with Indiana that we've seen with the Storm. Like, the Storm is trying to integrate two star players, but Indiana, like, is going to build everything around Caitlin Clark and had 2 weeks to do it in training camp. And their best perimeter player, I should say, last season, Kelsey Mitchell, who's been an all-star, missed much of training camp with an ankle injury of her own and came off the bench the first two games. The first two games, they lost by a combined 57 points against Connecticut and New York, who I think are two of the team league's three best teams. Last two games they played those teams again, lost to them by 15, and nearly took out Connecticut on Monday for their first win.
okay, so Indiana's putting it together a little bit. The
Yeah.
Storm could easily lose this game.
It's
How
losable. It's
common is it for a player? I mean, I know that a player like Caitlin Clark maybe hasn't existed before, but for star players coming from college, how common is it for them to? Because Stewie was pretty amazing right away, right?
It was interesting. I looked this up because I was looking up like bad 3-point shooting for the Storm, and it was either their fewest made or their fewest attempted since Stewie's WNBA debut, which they lost by like 30 at LA, but they did win her next game. And she was a top five player in the league as a rookie.
Is that and that's not like within the expect. The league is better than when Stewie was a rookie, right? Talent overall.
A little bit. I think it's more I think the fair argument. So I wrote about this, before the draft, that on the one hand, like, there'll be people who talk about like rookies are never any good in the WNBA, and like, look, it's so unfair they don't get a break between college and the start of the WNBA season, which is for the same reasons we've just talked about, exacerbated this year. But like, it's not uncommon for rookies to be among the 10 best players in the WNBA. I thought Aaliyah Boston was. She was on my all WNBA first team last year for the Fever. But what we see is those are often post players that have an easier transition to the WNBA. The kind of ball dominant guards like Caitlin, who have come out in the league as number one picks, Kelsey Plum, Sabrina Ionescu, both of whom we saw a ton of in college here in the Pacific Northwest, those players need a little bit of time. Sabrina only played three games as a rookie because she had a severe ankle sprain that ended her season. But I think you remember that her debut was against the Storm team that went on to win the championship in the WUBL. And they just like were all over her defensively. There was a play where Ezzie Meg Bagori in her WNBA debut switched out on Sabrina and just stoned her. And it was like, oh, what's going on
How is
here?
Kelsey Plum now? Where does Kelsey Plum like rank over WNBA rank? Where is she?
We had her in the top 10.
In the
I think
top.
she was
Oh,
not.
so
I think
Kelsey
she was
Plum's
ninth.
really good now.
Yeah. We had her ahead of Ionescu.
And when she was in San Antonio, she was kind of considered a bust early on.
Yeah. I mean, she had a very disappointing start to her career. And it turned out that she was not a point guard. They needed to get her off the ball and put her in a position to, kind of look to score first. And it's interesting, like, Chelsea Gray is out for Las Vegas right now. They're starting point guard, and they lost to Phoenix. I mean, unless that game changed after we started podcasting, they lost to Phoenix at home tonight. But, or yeah, but. Like, even with Chelsea Gray out, they're still making Jackie Young their point guard, not Kelsey Plum. So that's, and the same thing happened with Sabrina Ionescu, who's now playing alongside the all-time, the number two all-time assist in Courtney Vandersloot. Like, she's playing almost exclusively shooting guard. So it's interesting. I don't think that's going to be the case for Caitlin, but, one of the things you would like to see is take advantage of her shooting ability more off ball. Right now, teams have just basically been loading up on her and denying her the ball. Dejanire Carrington defended her for Connecticut, Bettina Jelani Hamilton for New York, and she hasn't had the ability to kind of leverage that defensive attention in ways to free up things for her teammates. I wrote about this in a.
Was that not a thing that they were doing it at Iowa?
I mean, it was, like... but it's just like the players you're doing this against aren't as good.
Yeah.
Like, Bettina Jelani is one of the strongest perimeter players in the league and quick enough to keep up with Caitlin. Like, I mean, this is maybe the example of it. It was Nika Mule who was doing this in the Final Four and did a really good job of it. But like, Nika Mule is not a WNBA All-Star. She's maybe a backup point guard.
Yeah.
So again, there's levels to this.
Yeah. I mean, I felt after watching the national championship game, just with how South Carolina, right? How South Carolina kind of shut her down with size and physicality after the early couple of minutes. I was like, I think it's going to be an interesting transition to the NBA or to the WNBA.
I mean, the thing to me that has been unexpected is that the rest of this Indiana team hasn't been as good. Aaliyah Boston is off to a really slow start. I mentioned this in the piece that we did, the group piece that we did on ESPN.com. That'll be out Wednesday morning. She'd never had a four-game shooting stretch as bad as her first four games all her rookie season.
Aaliyah Boston.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hasn't really seemed to have the lift going one-on-one, so that's been kind of confusing. But, like, they should have good enough players. And we started to see more of that against the Connecticut game. Temi Fegbenle, who's a veteran of overseas play from Great Britain, which we'll be talking about a little bit, the Great Britain basketball tradition, has really stepped into a nice role for them and helped them a lot on Monday.
All right.
So this will be an interesting matchup for sure. And hopefully Neko Okumike is out there. All right, UW softball, we're pouring some out for the 2024 season. They did beat Indiana 8-7 in a wild opening game of the NCAA tournament on Friday. They took a 4-1 lead into the fifth before the Hoosiers got to Ruby Malin on in relief of Lindsay Lopez for four runs in the inning. Indiana then made it 6-4 heading to the bottom of the sixth, where the Huskies took a 7-6 lead thanks to a Hoosiers error. Sydney Peters blew the save opportunity with Indiana tying it up at 7 only for Giselle Alvarez to walk it off with a two-out double in the bottom of the seventh. The Huskies then seemingly got a break because Omaha beat host Missouri 3-1 in extra innings in the other half of the bracket, setting up a matchup against the Mavericks on Saturday. UW opened up a 2-0 lead in the top of the first, but after three scoreless innings from Peters, who was starting in this one, Omaha exploded for three runs in the bottom of the fourth, and that was it. Huskies rarely threatened over the final three innings. That sent them into an elimination game against Missouri, the host, later Saturday. Malin started but was knocked out in the third after giving up a pair of solo home runs. Huskies scratched out a run in the fifth but saw the Tigers pad the lead to 4-1 in the bottom half of the inning. And that was that on a season that really kind of went out with a whimper for the Huskies, I would say.
Yeah, not a great season. Is this the last team? Is this the last significant sport to finish before UW is in the Big Ten?
It's the last sport we're covering to finish.
So that's
baseball,
it.
Barring a dramatic run, they are not in the roundup.
That game was kind of it for the Pac-12 era for the Pelton cast.
Yeah.
Kind of wild.
I mean, it's weird because we've talked about this. Like, we've mentally transitioned to the Big Ten for football so long ago that thinking about it for softball, like Pac-12 for softball, has been funny. Huskies got run ruled in the baseball got run ruled in the opening game of the Pac-12 tournament, 12-0 in seven innings by Cal. So I don't know that they're making the run down. They've lost seven in a row, it looks like.
That team is bad. Yeah.
Since they did take down number 23 Oregon at home in their final home series of the season.
All right. What about another team that we're going to be thinking about playing in the Big Ten next year?
All right. Well, we talked about this at the top. UW men's basketball adding English transfer from Utah State, Rait Osabor. who had this to say: Washington will allow me to maximize my potential as a player in my final year of college basketball. Coach Brinkel has been with me every step of the way since I came from England, and I cannot wait to help the Huskies get back to the NCAA tournament. Of course, the real story here is that my ESPN colleague Jonathan Givony, who reported this, also reported that Osabor has NIL deals in place worth $2 million, the most known for any men's college basketball player for the upcoming season.
Incredible. Great Osabor, the highest paid player in all of the NCAA. Is this mostly just because we don't know the numbers from other players? Like, why is this known and the others aren't?
I mean, I think, it depends on what the agent is, the player's agents are willing to disclose, and not everyone's
Do
going to
they
want to do that.
have
But
agents?
oh yeah, they just straight up have agents now.
Wait, really? Like William Morris, CA, people like that? Like, you could just have a legit agent, or does it have to be like the same agents as, let's say, an NBA player would have?
I believe your agent will generally carry over you to your professional career, yes.
But so they could hire an agent. You could just hire an agent now. You're just,
Yes.
I had no idea that that was the case.
Yeah.
I
So
mean,
you would think
we're
if
in the
someone,
new world. We are here.
we're not fully in the new world, but we're very close to it. Some pending litigation that's going to be resolved that will thrust us directly, firmly into the new world of college
Oh,
sports.
I think that's coming ASAP, right? I
No,
just
it's
saw
very soon,
that
yes.
the ACC and the Big 12 are already approved, and that the Pac-12 was voting as an old school group. It's all going to be approved very, very soon here.
So you would think if you were an agent and you negotiated a better deal for your player than Great Osabor has, that you would probably want to make that known.
So you think there's a
So.
chance that Great Osabor's agent was just like, I mean, it's good for the players for these numbers to be out there. It's not bad for anybody.
I mean, it does create like a certain attention on the money. I mean, I mean, look, in professional sports, agents leak the salary info regularly, so clearly it seems to work to the benefit because it creates a competitive market. I do think with college players in particular, like, it creates a scrutiny in a way that didn't exist before. I mean, that's not a reason to not pay the money, but it might be a reason to not talk about the money.
I talked about paying that $18 a month for Root Sports. And you know what? The Mariners have really held up their end of the bargain. So,
So also where we've
I worth it is not exactly the way to describe it. But I do think when you talk about that NIL money, part of the Danny Sprinkle hire, part of what UW is trying to do right now, and former athletic director before then, current athletic director, Pat Shunn. You don't hire Danny Sprinkle without giving him the tools to be successful. And I think that's kind of the main thing. And that's where UW is at right now as they go into the Big Ten. This is a Jed Fish issue. This is a Danny Sprinkle issue. You don't hire these coaches, pay them the salaries you're paying them, go into the Big Ten, and then handcuff them without the money that they need to be competitive. So I think it was this number coming out, and for all that we know, publicly known, UW having paid the highest amount for any transfer this offseason in NIL money, I think it's kind of a significant thing,
oh,
which
yeah.
is to say that UW is a program that is not just the fact that it was basketball in particular, which is to say that UW, obviously football is going well, that we're committed as they join the Big Ten to also being a basketball school, and that UW is going to be thinking about prioritizing spending on sports during this transition. They uprooted the whole fucking campus to go to a different conference. You know what I mean? Like, this wasn't just a perspective that affects only the basketball team, only the football team, only sports in general. This affects everybody. At the institution of the University of Washington is now linked to the Big Ten. They have left the conference that they were in for 100 years that guided them. You don't go there to fuck around. And I think that's what this is a little bit of a sign of, is that they are here to compete. In the new world that we are entering into, UW is going to be a player, and they don't see themselves as stepping stone school. They don't see them as Danny Sprinkles waiting until he gets a better job. They are here to compete at the highest possible level.
One of the things I mentioned when back during the UW coaching search was that, like, there was a Matt Norlander piece that I had read, where someone had asked, like, which, I think this was a question of a College Basketball Insider that he posed, actually, like, which college teams have better NIL operations than you would realize. And he flagged UW as one of those. And like, this certainly is better than we realized, but they outcompeted Kentucky, among other schools, to get Grace Osabor's services. And like, obviously the Danny Sprinkle ties are a big factor in this, but he was, that was what was needed, plus the deal to get Great Osabor, and they had
Okay,
that ab ability.
so Great Osabor, we know Cam Ward, right? One of the, we have no idea what the final dollar amount was, million plus, right, for a starting quarterback. Great Osabor, you only have five basketball players on the court at a time, but impact wise, do we feel like Great Osabor is the kind of player who would warrant this kind of money, being the biggest money in NIL
I don't
right
think
here?
he's going to be the best player in college basketball next year, I'll say that. But I think he will be the best player that we've had at UW in a few years.
Interesting.
Last year at Utah State, when he was Mountain West Conference Player of the Year, 7.6 box plus minus per sportsreference.com. Only two Huskies reached that mark in the Mike Hopkins era, Matisse Thybulle and Terrell Brown Jr. And those were both guys who were in Conference Player of the Year discussion. So that's the level that we're
I
talking
barely
about.
remember Terrell Brown Jr. being a player at all, but
He
yes.
led the conference in scoring, and UW was actually like pretty decent in conference play that year after the non-conference was pretty awful and knocked them out of NCAA tournament consideration. It's an interesting backstory how quickly he's emerged. He, even as a sophomore at Montana State under Sprinkle, was, I believe he was conference sixth man of the year. He averaged 19 minutes per game, made just two starts, then goes to Utah State and is the best player in the Mountain West Conference. I would say if you're kind of imagining what he plays like, I swear I don't do this both because they're English. It's a little like statistically like Matthew Bryan Amining's senior year when he really broke out in a big way. The difference here being that NBA never recorded many assists, and Great Osabor is a bit of a hub offensively for Utah State. That's how he's been used.
So
And
what would you say anticipation wise for this Husky basketball team? How does Great Osabor change your perspective, assuming the roster is mostly set
the roster
for
is
the
set.
2020? Okay.
Boring to change the roster is set. So their last scholarship spot is going to be another transfer, easy for me to say, North Dakota guard Tyree Iheanacho, a fifth-year senior who played two separate stints with the Fighting Hawks, spending 2 years at James Madison in between. Iheanacho was pretty much a defender at JMU, but averaged 14.5 points per game last season, in addition to 3.9 assists per game. 6'4" and a solid rebounder, so can probably handle some small forward and three guard lineups, which is nice, given that's kind of the biggest need for the Huskies. But another iffy shooter, he took five threes per game, but shot just 29% from the field. I would say the Huskies have a lot of ball handlers. They have a lot of post players, and the question is going to be whether they have enough shooting and size on the wing to make it work.
Okay.
That's what's going to determine if this is an NCAA tournament team. So the guards, you have Iheanacho, Rice transfer Mekhi Mason, Butler transfer DJ Davis, Rhode Island transfer Luis Courtright, and then the freshman Zoum Diallo, who did reaffirm his commitment to UW after reopening that, and then Jace Butler. At forward, you have Portland transfer Tyler Harris, who we talked about last week, is kind of a combo forward who's probably going to end up at the three, given the Huskies' positional depth. I think Osabor slots in as a power forward, even though he split time at power forward and center at Utah State. Redshirt freshman Christian King would be really helpful if he could step into a rotation role, because he's probably the best shooter on the roster. And then Oakland transfer Chris Conway, another 4-5. A lot of size on this team for sure.
I'm gonna forget, and we're gonna get to like November, and I'm gonna forget every single player on this team aside from Great Osabor and Zoum Diallo.
Oh, the disrespect to Wilhelm Breidenbach is
Okay, there's
noted.
also Thrillhelm Breidenbach.
Frank Kepnong, Wilhelm
And
Breidenbach, and then you've got the
man,
Oregon State transfer Casey Ebekwe at center. So
I do think that the big depth is, I mean, they almost didn't need Great Osabor as much as I feel like other teams would, but
but they needed him in terms of like the shot creation and the star power. That's what they
okay.
needed him in terms of. Maybe not in terms of
And
positional
you're not
size.
going to count on Kepnong necessarily, given how his season ended.
I think that's part of the reason that they overloaded on center depth. Yes.
It is, they are very big.
They're ready to be in foul trouble in the Big Ten, which is weird because they
But
don't call as many fouls in the Big Ten.
thank God. Oh my God. But there's a good chance that I'm going to forget all of these players as they're brand new. So we'll learn who they are again next year.
I may have forgotten some of them since we discussed them. Yes.
But I do think this is a significant move it means that the team at the very least is going to go into this next Big Ten season and they're going to be part of the conversation. It's not going to be just like this UW team in the post Mike Hopkins era could have been pretty forgotten. And I think this move is a huge one to make sure that they're in the mix as far as the NCAA tournament goes. So I'm freaking hyped about Great Osabor. I guess my final question for you, and with regards to NIL money, was Great Osabor, is he an NBA draft prospect at all?
He did enter the draft this year before withdrawing. I would say that he has to probably show pretty significant development as a shooter because, you know, he's 6'8". He's probably not good enough defensively to make it as a center at the pro level. Although, I mean, you do see guys who are able to do that. You think of Eugene Omoruyi was someone who's even smaller, though he does shoot the three, but has like really primarily been a center in his NBA career. So it's possible. I think he's probably more likely a two-way guy. You know, that's what Keon Brooks Jr. I'm sure is hoping for. He participated in the G League Elite.
What is the money like
combine
for a two-way player?
I think it ends up being like a maximum of like 500K per season, but don't hold me to that. That's off the top of my head.
So this deal that Great Osabor has is a better deal than, I mean, this is the best situation for players who belong in college and aren't necessarily NBA players. Go get paid.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen plenty of examples of it already.
How far do you think we are from contracts?
I think the latest changes seem to open the door for it.
You
and
think
also
the current litigation is going to open the door to contracts?
Well, also is it Jalen or Jaden Rashada? His lawsuit is basically like breach of contract for NIL promises. Uh-huh. Have you not seen this?
The quarterback for Florida.
Yeah, he committed to Florida.
Jaden Rashada. And has he played yet?
No, I don't think so.
He committed to Florida. Well, it looks like now he's committed to Georgia, but.
Well, yeah, because they went back on the contract. He did spend last year at Arizona State. Played three games there.
When did this happen?
So this is in like January 2003.
Interesting. I mean, that's where we're headed.
Yeah.
We're headed to contracts. It'll honestly, people will be happy with contracts. People might think they're unhappy with contracts. People will be happy with contracts because it'll keep players at colleges longer. I think there is a reality that they're not going to be 1-year contracts. And eventually, we're going to get to multi-year deals for players so that you don't pay somebody whatever money to come in as a freshman and then have them leave after that freshman year, or at least without any sort of compensation for it. So people are going to prefer this overall because I think there's a good chance that it'll kind of end the era of everybody changes teams every offseason.
Yes, which I don't think people really like, even though certainly we want the players to have the freedom to transfer as they wish.
We like the idea of players getting paid, but like, it's not like in the NFL, you're like, man, I wish that every player had the freedom. Like if a team has a really good player, like they're going to be trades that are going to happen. That's what this is going to look like. People are going to trade contracts.
I don't know if we'll see trades necessarily. As I've said, I think the soccer transfer model is a more likely and more sensible outcome for college sports.
We'll
so
see.
Where it has to be a mutual consent by both sides, but the team gets a financial, you know, it's like when a coach leaves, you get the buyout.
Yeah.
So
that makes more sense. But I think there's going to be more multi-year deals and players will stay at colleges for longer than they are, because right now the system, I think that's what people don't like, is having to look at the UW.
Well, they do have contracts right now. It's just all of the contracts are a 1-year contract.
Yes. But I think we're going to have longer contracts. Maybe. Or some players. Some players will have longer contracts.
I think everyone would sign a longer contract and then just agitate to renegotiate if you do well.
Yeah.
That's how pro sports works. It's not like everyone just is signing a 1-year deal every year as a free agent. You sign a long-term deal and then you ask for a trade.
Yeah. Can't wait.
I'm so sick of talking about transfers. Too much transfer research for 1 year. I'm just tapped out.
Been a lot. Speaking of which,
Well, first, we're going to note that Quincy Pondexter is officially joining Will Conroy on Eric Musselman's staff at USC. So good luck to the former Husky assistant coaches there. UW football adding a couple more transfers. Sac State safety Cam Broussard, who is a starter the last 2 years, made all Big Sky first team as a free safety at 6'3". As a junior, he has 1 year of eligibility remaining. And then JUCO tackle Maximus McCree, who is listed at 6'6", 293, spent 2022 with Maryland after 1 year in the JC ranks, played just 2 games there. No, I guess it was 2 years in the JC ranks, but 1 year of eligibility. That was his sophomore year. Then came to Maryland from Iowa Central Community College.
Give me a giant lineman named Maximus.
It is an amazing day.
Oh, yes. There's nothing I love more than a giant lineman named Maximus. Come on.
Seahawks, not a lot going on, but seven of it of the eight rookies are under contract.
We
So,
also, the schedule was released.
oh,
We
the
just have
schedule.
no thoughts.
I completely forgot. You forgot that the Great Osabor thing had happened since we last podcasted, because it happened like the day after. I forgot that the schedule was released. So, the Seahawks opened with the Denver Broncos. Wow, what an exciting return! Like that's. Oh no. No,
Oh
not
no.
anymore. No.
Is that here or there?
That's here.
Okay, thank
So it's the
God.
exact same setup. Week one against Denver is
I
2022.
mean, honestly, the chance to make if Bo Nix is the starter for Denver, the chance to beat Bo Nix in week one in Seattle is a beautiful thing.
That would be very exciting. I mean, people noted with the schedule release how many of the rookie quarterbacks the Seahawks have a chance to play. Obviously, that was already true. We already knew all the
Exactly.
opponents.
It's like
The Broncos being the week one opponent probably makes it less likely that it's Bo Nix or, the Patriots in week two. Same thing with a rookie quarterback. The national TV games, Monday Night Football against at Detroit on September 30th in week four.
Because of course.
Thursday Night Football against the 49ers at home on October the 10th.
I felt like a Thursday night game against the Niners was also kind of like set in stone.
Sunday Night Football against the Green Bay
Who's gonna
Packers in week
Jared
15.
Stidham? It's Bo Nix's job. Like, is Zach Wilson gonna go win that job? They're starting Bo
But
Nix in
you
that
know how
game.
many times, like, who's getting started over Deshaun Watson the first 3 games of the season in Houston? It wasn't still Brock Osweiler, was it?
I think Brock Osweiler was after.
That's funny. That possibility. That can't possibly be true, can it?
I don't think they had Brock Osweiler pre Deshaun Watson.
Russell has been out of the
28
NFL a
years
long time.
old.
Deshaun or Brock?
Deshaun.
Yeah, Brock Osweiler was drafted the same year as Russell Wilson. Speaking of Broncos quarterbacks.
I don't buy it.
There you go. I don't know. There is obviously a degree of interest, especially if you're planning trips or
Houston
to
had
go to games.
already traded Brock Osweiler to Cleveland for draft picks.
Yeah. That happened a long time ago, man.
But they traded him away. Tom Savage started.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. Muscle man Tom Savage.
I worked.
Honestly, I feel like Tom Savage, low-key kind of good.
I
Always
worked with
loved Tom
a
Savage.
Tom Savage at the Sonics, and that always made me laugh. Tom Savage, the NFL quarterback, he finished his career with a 2-7 record as a starting
Yeah,
QB.
but Tom Savage was kind of good.
He threw 7 interceptions and 5 touchdowns.
The entire Brock Osweiler Texans era had already concluded by the time Deshaun Watson got there, and I'm old.
That's as good of a well, leading up to your birthday. I guess that's as good a place as any to include this.
We also this weekend say goodbye to Full Tilt in West Seattle. We
Yeah, we
grown
talked
up.
about this on the pod. That's a
I
tremendously
believe
sad thing for.
Sunday is the last day, right?
It sounds right. Yeah, tremendously sad thing in the wake of the passing of Justin Klein. So, a white center fixture.
And on that note,
Thanks for listening.